Welcome to Double Dribble here on WakeUpCallDT.com, part of Dan Tatora Broadcast Media, with Dave Pasiak, OCC men's head basketball coach. All throughout the 21st century with the Lasers, and here with us every single week to talk about basketball as the basketball analyst of WakeUpCallDT.com and Dan Tatora Broadcast Media. Of course, I'm Dan Tatora here with you and Dave to talk about the NBA Finals and to take a look at professional basketball in general today. We're looking at Game 6, but before we break down that game and what happened in Game 5, let's get Dave back on the line here. Dave, how you doing?
I'm great, Dan. How you doing today?
I'm doing well and happy to have you back here on the show. And first and foremost, Game 5, we had talked about a pattern going into Game 5 of the Miami Heat, that it's loss, win, loss, win, loss is where they ended up. Now, going into the game, it was loss, win, loss, win. So if the pattern follows, they would lose that game, and they ended up losing that game. And when you look at the Miami Heat, and they've been talked about so much as being this responder team, not a team that's going to come out and have a preemptive strike, but be a good response team. But if this pattern continues itself, they won't have a time to respond. And what did you take from the fact that their pattern continues?
Well, I think it's attributed to, you say the same thing about San Antonio. I mean, they've responded after Miami wins, but I think it comes back to being a series, making the game adjustments. I think the one thing in Game 5 that was a little bit different from, like, Game 3, where San Antonio just ran Miami out of the gym. In Game 5, I thought Miami really played with a lot of energy and a lot of effort. San Antonio had a 20-point lead. Miami got it back to 1. San Antonio pushed it out to double figures again, and Miami made a run late in the fourth quarter and actually had it down to single digits and, with a minute or two to go, was probably about a play or two from really making it interesting coming down a stretch. So I think that, one of the things is they haven't gotten a level of consistency out of some of the supporting cast. I think Wade has played better as the series has gone on. Bosch has played a little bit better. I mean, Ray Allen has been Ray Allen, but, where they've had a lot of, LeBron obviously has been LeBron, but where they've had a lot of up and down is kind of the role players, the Millers and the Cole, Chalmers, Haslam. Those guys have been very, very erratic. And I think, as opposed to San Antonio, where you've had, Leonard has been consistently excellent throughout the series, and you got a guy like Danny Green who, the series ended today, he's the MVP. He shot the ball at an unbelievable rate throughout the whole series.
One of the guys that you brought up, Dave, that I want to talk about first is Mario Chalmers, because I think last season when the Miami Heat did win the NBA Finals, he was one of the unsung heroes. He was a guy who stepped up when Dwayne Wade struggled, LeBron James had trouble shooting. Mario Chalmers really was the guy in the NBA Finals predominantly. I mean, he had his moments throughout the postseason, but in the 2012 NBA Finals, he really stepped up to take charge of what Miami needed to do, what they were lacking, and really filled in the gaps. So has his subpar performance been a direct issue with the Miami Heat? Because when he was doing well, he wasn't getting talked about, but obviously without him, I don't think they would have won that championship last season.
Well, even in this series, I mean, he was in Game 2, he was really impressive. He had a great game playing off of LeBron James. They involved Chalmers and LeBron in screen and roll, and Chalmers really gave San Antonio a lot of problems getting in the lane and getting to the basket. And since Game 2, he's been a non-factor to almost a negative factor in some of the games since then. So, I think he's an example of a guy who's kind of a complimentary player, but a really talented complimentary player. And when he's playing well, I think it gives Miami an extra guy that San Antonio or whoever they have to be playing has to be concerned with, and just makes them a much more dangerous team and much more difficult team to deal with, as opposed to when he's playing poorly or erratically, then his matchup is available to give a lot more help on LeBron, on Wade, on some of the other threats that Miami has.
I think that, spending so much time on the big three and who's the big three, you know, the Boston Celtics and then with the Miami Heat and back in history of having the big three. But really with Miami, in my mind, you know, this is a team that obviously LeBron James and Dwayne Wade are expected to be your top contributors and have been for the most part since they've been teammates. But when you have Udonis Haslem coming off the bench at times, when you have Shane Battier, you have Norris Cole, you have Ray Allen, you have Birdman, when these guys get themselves involved, it seems like even if it doesn't always show up on the stat sheet, that without them, there's no championship for Miami. That between LeBron James and Dwayne Wade, if you're going to see 50 points or 60 points, you still have to account for 40 more points that you're going to need to score. And San Antonio has proven that they can run the score up pretty high. So to me, I think they're not talked about enough, but without these role players and without these surrounding players, they really are the difference between a championship or going home without the trophy for Miami because of what they're able to do and because of the point that you brought up that when they're playing well, then they call the defense to come on them as opposed to double-teaming a LeBron or a Dwayne Wade.
Well, I think you're, I mean, I agree with you 100%. I think that the supporting cast at Miami, I think they've got a collection of guys that really complement LeBron's skills and Wade's skills to a degree and play off those guys, but it comes down to making shots. You know, you got a guy, Miller, who was coming off the bench for the first three games and shooting the lights out and looked like he had a lot of energy, and he got inserted in the starting lineup in game four and really hasn't scored and hasn't gotten a lot of shots in a starter's role. The one thing he has done is he's opened the floor up a little bit and helped their spacing. So I think having Miller in the lineup has helped Wade in particular. But, you know, Miller was a guy that when he was coming off the bench was really a weapon for him. And, like, in game five, if you added up LeBron and Wade and Bosch, they collectively exceeded their average. Where Miami didn't get production was from some of the supporting cast.
Looking at the Spurs, though, and going to the other side, when you said Miami doesn't get the support of some of their cast there that's there on the bench that they don't have that help, when you look on the other side and you look to a team like the San Antonio Spurs, who have you been most impressed with, Dave, when you look at this team? And obviously the names Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, Manu Ginobili are always going to come up, but outside of that, is it a guy like Gary Neal that's sticking out to you? Do you see something in Tiago Splitter that maybe some other people don't see? Who's really made an imprint on your mind, especially with you being a coach, of not being in the big three but yet still being such a big presence?
Well, I think Leonard has had a great series for them. I think in four of the five games, he's done a pretty good job on LeBron James defensively, and he's also been a contributor on offense. But obviously, I mean, the difference maker in this series for San Antonio has been Danny Green. I think without his play and without his ability to shoot the ball, I think this series would have been long over, and you know, Miami would be celebrating the championship because Green has really been the guy whose play has. His play in the finals has really exceeded expectation, probably more so than anybody on either team. You know, Ginobili has had a nothing finals until game five where he, you know, he kind of came to life, started for the first time in over a year and really responded well and played well. But, you know, Duncan has been Duncan. Parker has been very effective in a lot of games, but he's had a couple of games where he's been nagged with an injury. But Green has been the guy that I think coming into the series, you know, he's a 10-point-a-game scorer coming into the series. And you know, I heard a stat where if he ends up being the MVP, he'll be the second lowest scoring average, regular season scoring average of any MVP in the history of the league, next to Wes Unseld when he won the MVP, averaging about 8 points a game in the regular season.
When you see that's a possibility, and you've been a proponent for Danny Green being the MVP if San Antonio does in fact win, we've talked about things not always showing up on the stat sheet. What has he done for this team that has put him in that place in your mind to elevate above everybody else, that if that MVP trophy is going to be handed out and San Antonio is the victor in the finals, that it should go to Danny Green?
Well, he's making shots. It's simple as that. I mean, he's making shots. He's getting himself open and making Miami guard him and respect him. you know, and when they haven't, and even when they have, he's made them play. I mean, he's shooting, in the postseason, he's shooting over 50% from three, and in the finals, he's shooting over 65% from three, and, you know, that's the kind of thing that it's not sustainable over an 82-game season, but over a seven-game series so far, it has been through the first five, and, you know, it's just his thing is the ability to knock down shots, and he's doing it at an incredibly high and incredibly efficient rate.
Looking to somebody who obviously can knock down shots at a high rate as well, Ray Allen, you brought him up. I think looking at him, he's in his 17th season now, and the interesting part of this is in every season, he's always started in the majority of games. For Miami, 79 games played in and 0 games as a starter. However, his minutes are still close to what he used to have. Still looks like starter minutes. He's playing just under 26 minutes a game. His shooting overall is right about where it was last season at 45%. He's still better than 40% from three-point line. He's still about 90% from the free throw line. So when you, and he's still averaging double figures in points. So Ray Allen, to me, is this guy who, yeah, he's taken on a different role and he's not asked to be one of the main players, but he still, on paper, looks like a starter, is a main contributor, and is still doing what he's doing in his 17th year. What can you say about the talent of Ray Allen and how Miami has figured out a way to really utilize him as a weapon in not only the NBA Finals, but since they got him?
Well, I mean, Ray Allen, he's just a consummate pro, and I think that one of the things that attracted him to Miami and attracted Miami to him, was attracted from Miami to him, was that, you know, maybe physically he's not the player that he was quickness-wise and those types of things from earlier in his career, but he's got one, you know, a great skill in that how he shoots the basketball. You know, he can't play the same number of minutes that he's played over the course of his NBA career. But he can knock down open shots, and he's very good at playing without the ball and playing off of guys who will get him the ball. And LeBron James is as good as that, you know, creating for his teammates as anybody in the league. So, you know, Allen, I think, is a great veteran presence for them, and I think his skills complement the things that James and Wade do extremely well.
Is there anybody in the NBA that is better coming right off of a screen, or, you know, creating their own shot, not just being open, but being able to get the ball and create for themselves their own opportunities, coming off a ball screen, moving without the ball, whatever it may be? Is there anyone better than Ray Allen when it comes to getting that ball and making sure that he's got to look at the basket?
Well, I mean, he's certainly one of the best ever in the league. You know, Reggie Miller was another guy when he was playing, was the same way. Rip Hamilton, I think, is one of the guys who's, you know, one of the best players in the history of the league at moving without the ball, and, you know, Ray Allen certainly ranks right up there, you know, in the recent history of the league with all those guys. I think, you know, he's a guy that I'm sure figured out very early on, you know, how important it was to be good without the ball in order to be able to do the things that he excels at once he gets the ball. You know, I mean, he puts the ball on the floor a little bit and create a little bit for himself, probably not as much now as he did earlier in his career, but he's a great, great catch-and-shoot player, and certainly has learned to do the things without the ball that are necessary to be able to maximize his opportunities once he gets it.
When you look at the opportunities that both of these teams have had to really take an advantage but have not been able to do so, we look at the first half, which you and I have talked about off the air, and the fact that when you watch the first half of really any of these games, Miami and San Antonio are relatively close, and it's a game. In the second half, it opens up, but it's not just San Antonio's fault, and it's not just Miami's fault. What do you believe is contributing to such a different second half as compared to the first half, when you see a lot of competitiveness and not necessarily a lack of competitiveness, but just teams that seem to branch out to these big leads, substantial leads that they didn't have in the first half?
I think when you boil it down to its simplest elements, it's what team happens to be making shots. I mean, you know, the other night San Antonio shot over 60% from the floor. I mean, that hasn't happened in an NBA final in several years. And, you know, they shot the ball at a rate that Miami, regardless of how well they were competing and whatnot, just was not, you know, was not equipped to match up with. And the same thing happened in reverse, you know, in game two when Miami really put the wood to San Antonio. A lot of the complimentary players that we're talking about that haven't made shots in a couple of games really were able to capitalize on that. So I think it's as simple as that. As, you know, which team has shot the ball better has been the team that's been able to capitalize.
When we look back on five games and you look at the scores, some of the scores close. The first game, 92-88, 114-104 in game five. But then there's your games 103-84, 113-77. One game goes in San Antonio's favor, the other game goes in Miami's favor. When you look at, I mean, we talk about shooting and who's having a great shooting night. Did you think that in this finals, the way that these teams play each other at times in games and over the course of the finals, did you think that you would see such wide margins of victory by either San Antonio or Miami?
No, you know, it's been a funny series and an intriguing series in that respect. Is that I think it's closely contested, and I think, you know, the two teams are relatively evenly matched, but the individual games haven't been that closely contested. And, you know, so if you look at the series on balance, you know, it looks like it's been a close competitive series, which, you know, it has, looking at the end result, but the individual games really haven't been as much. And, you know, we're still waiting for, you know, we're through five games and we haven't, I think game one was a game where neither team played all that well, and we got a pretty close game. You know, just think about if that ball doesn't come off Parker's hand, you know, for another tenth of a second, how much different the whole complexion of the series is. You know, in games two through five, I don't think we've had in all four of those games, I think one of the two teams has really played at close to their peak level, and the other team has not, and it's led to the spreads. And what we really, you know, hopefully we'll see in a game six or, you know, potentially a game seven is that game where both teams are really playing at their peak and at their best. And, you know, we get a high level game for 48 minutes out of both teams and a ball in the air at the final buzzer moment, you know, to win an NBA title would be certainly exciting.
When you watch the NBA Finals, not just this season, but in the 21st century, what type of emotions does it create for you? What type of thoughts do you have in comparison to what the finals used to look like in the 80s, in the 90s, 70s? You know, as far back as you want to go, when you look at the NBA Finals now, what comparison or contrast do they have in your mind from what you're used to seeing from being a guy that's obviously stayed in touch with the NBA for a long time?
Well, I think, you know, you got to take everything in the context of the era that you're playing in. And, you know, the game changes over time. And the NBA, I thought, as a league, in recent years has done a really good job of kind of cleaning up some of the hand-checking and holding on the perimeter, and it's made it more of a freedom of movement, free-flowing game. You know, so you get, it's made it more, put more of a premium on perimeter play and everything. You know, you go to the NBA, like in the days of the Bad Boy Pistons, or even in Magic Johnson's era, where, like, Magic would struggle, would have to change, he wouldn't struggle because he's a great player, he'd still be a great player today, but he would have to change his game in today's game because, I mean, Magic would just put his forearm on the other guard and control him, and, you know, that's the kind of thing that isn't party to today's game. You know, conversely, defenses are more sophisticated today because the illegal defense things have changed, and teams can play zone and give more help and all that. So I think the way the game is played changes over time, and I mean, the NBA went through a stretch where the league was very, very geared towards offense, and games were routinely played in a, you know, well into the hundreds, and then that kind of came full circle, and the league became much more, you know, much more of a grinder period of time where, you know, it was about physical play and a lot of hand checking and holding and grabbing, and the games became more ugly, and you know, now I think that what they've done a good job of is kind of getting back to more of a balance where I think, like, this series, when these teams are playing well, I think the games are fun to watch and there's flow to it and everything. And you know, a lot of that has come from how the league wants the game officiated. I thought for the first four games of this series, the officials have done a really good job of staying out of the way. The last game, I thought, was Game 5 was probably the poorest officiated. And, you know, Joey Crawford's on Game 6, so you always have your concerns when he's coming out there that that he'll make himself part of the game. But, you know, I think you got to take each year and each era for what it is. And you know, the NBA Finals, it's the best basketball played in the world by some of the best teams and best players.
When you see the score, and as you talked about getting well into the hundreds, a few years back, it was Phoenix, averaging over 100 points a game. Now teams can get up there without too much of a problem. Are there defenses that are playing better? Yes. Have you seen more fundamentals in a team like the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Chicago Bulls? Absolutely, in my mind. But do you think that fans have been, in a way, spoiled by teams getting into the hundreds, and it's not just the Phoenix Suns, and it's becoming more of an average with more and more teams, that if the game doesn't get up into the hundreds, that some fans may feel that something was left on the floor that they're missing?
Nah, I don't think so at all. I think that's one of the things that's really good about the NBA now, is that I think there are a lot of good teams that play a variety of styles, and you can watch, an Indiana who's a little bit more of a grinder team with an inside presence with Hibbert and plays inside out, or Memphis even more so with Marc Gasol and Randolph that plays more of an inside out half court style game. You got the Denver Nuggets before they got rid of Carl, which is the opposite. They're kind of the free flowing, transition oriented team. You got Chicago, who's a grinder team. You got a team like San Antonio who put such a premium on offensive execution and sharing the ball versus a team like Oklahoma City, which is more about creating isolations and, opportunities to get their best players scoring opportunities in space and everything. So, I think the game is at a really good point today, because I think you can have success playing a variety of different ways. I don't think you have to be you mentioned the Phoenix Suns, the free flow and all. I don't think you have to be that kind of team or a bad boy Pistons, grind it out type of team. I think you can have success in the league today playing any number of styles that whatever happens to fit your personnel the best.
Going back to the NBA Finals in the here and now, I want to play a game, If Then. And I'm going to ask you a series of questions here on what you think can happen here with the personnel of the Miami Heat and the San Antonio Spurs. If San Antonio wins Game 6, then obviously the series is over. So we're not going to include that one. But if the Miami Heat win Game 6, then blank.
Then the Heat becomes a prohibitive favorite in Game 7 to capture a championship, best player in the world.
So to you, Miami, if they can get themselves to a Game 7 or more poised to win that game and settle this once and for all, which would mean that they would have to win back-to-back games for the first time.
Well, I think they got two games on their home court, and you play all season, they have the best record in the league and have home court advantage all the way through the playoffs and into the finals, and that's what they play for, and you're playing against another good team and you got the two games at home. So even though Miami is down 3-2, you have to like, I know they asked in the press conference, at the beginning of the year, if you could fast forward and say you're in the NBA Finals with two games at home to win the championship, would you take that? And I think pretty much to a man, everybody on the Heat roster and coaching staff would say yes.
If LeBron James struggles in Game 6, then who will step up?
Dwayne Wade has to play well also. I think Dwayne Wade for sure.
If Tim Duncan struggles with his shot in Game 6, then blank.
Then the Spurs really need to shoot the ball well to have a chance. If they're not getting much out of Duncan, then, Duncan has been solid but not spectacular the whole series, and I think San Antonio has been successful despite that, not having a really huge game out of Duncan, because they've gotten great perimeter play out of Green the whole series, and you know, Parker and Leonard and Ginobili the last game, Gary Neal for a couple of games. So I think they have to really, really shoot the ball well if they're not getting any inside scoring out of Duncan.
If in Game 6 both teams have role players that step up equally, then?
Then if they both have role players stepping up equally, then it comes back to, you know, then it comes back to the Stars, and you know, Miami has the best player on the floor. So advantage Miami.
And finally, if the San Antonio Spurs win the series either in Game 6 or Game 7, then what does this mean for the Miami Heat on the season?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people perceive it as Miami has to win the championship or the season's a failure. And I think, you know, on the one hand, people have to understand how difficult it is to get to an NBA final and to get there 3 years in a row. And I mean, Boston had, you know, Pierce, Garnett, and Allen together, their big three. They won one championship and had another finals experience, another finals appearance. And I think most people would tell you that that their big three run was pretty successful. Yet I think in Miami's case, there'll be a big perception from the public at large that it hasn't been successful and it's been a failure and everything. And that's probably a little bit unfair to their players and coaching staff and organization. But I think regardless of the outcome, I think it'll be interesting to see where both of these teams go in the offseason, because, you know, I think win or lose for Miami, and I think win or lose for San Antonio, I think you're going to see certain pieces that are core to both teams, you know, maybe not being there when the season opens up in November.
Who are some of those core pieces that you think could be moving?
Well, I mean, on Miami's side, you hear about things under the hood. Are they going to try to become more of a traditional team, look to bring more of an inside presence and have a traditional low post presence? And, I mean, if they go that route and try to get a guy of any stature, then you would think Bosch would be on the block. You know, some of their more veteran players, you don't know how much gas is in the tank. You know, Miller is probably near the end of his career. You know, Battier, Allen, Haslam's been there for a long period of time. You know, Birdman, they pulled him off the, off the unemployment line. So, you know, I think a lot of the supporting cast in Miami probably is going to get cycled out. You know, how many years has Ray Allen got left? The other thing I think that they're going to have to make a hard decision on is the point guard situation with Chalmers and Cole. And are those the guys to continue them at a high level, or do they need to make a move at that position?
When you look at a team like Miami, do you think that the best thing for them is to get these veterans that they can get cheap, bring them onto the team, have them there for a year, cycle them out, get new players? Or would you like to see them have more consistency in those role players?
Well, I think anytime you have a team that plays at a high level for an extended period of time, I mean, they're retooling every year. I mean, you go back to the Jordan Bulls and you look at what the roster looked like when they first started winning championships to what it looked like at the end. And, you know, early on they were Bill Cartwright and Horace Grant, you know, some of those guys in the in the rotation, and then later on it was Rodman and Tony Kukoc and Wennington, and you know, so I mean, any team that experiences success over a long period of time, you know, one of the things that's key to that is, you know, their front office staying a little bit ahead of the curve and making the right moves to replace some of their peripheral parts. And I think that's why San Antonio's been so good so long. I mean, they've managed to change the pieces that play around Duncan and Ginobili and Parker and stay at a high level. You know, so I mean, I don't think that's certainly not unusual, and it's something that I think any team that strives and excels for a long period of time is looking to do. I think the teams that stand pat a year too long are the ones that open themselves up to having that big drop off.
So you think that essentially to be a good organization when it comes to being competitive every year, that you have to be more open to having the players that you know you want to keep and rotating, as opposed to having pretty much the same roster top to bottom from year to year?
I think it's hard to have the same roster year to year. I mean, in all professional sports with free agency and salary caps and, you know, limits on players' contracts and all that thing, you know, I think it's not the NBA of the 60s where the Celtics can keep the entire roster intact for year after year after year and rattle off 8 straight championships. I think, Oklahoma City was a great example of that. I mean, they had to move Harden to get something for him because they can't afford to keep him on a max contract. So, San Antonio has guys like Leonard's a guy who is going to be worth a lot of money in this league, you know, in a year or two. And if they opt to, I'm sure they're going to try to keep him as a core guy when his contract comes due. You know, Ginobili's a guy who's probably close to the end of the line. They're going to have to make a decision on, and he's going to have to make a decision on coming back, and the same with Duncan. So I don't think in professional sports today, I don't think it's realistic that you can keep an entire roster intact for too awful long period of time because, with contracts and free agency and everything.
Last thing I want to ask you before we go here, Dave, here on Double Dribble with Dan Tatora and, of course, Dave Pasiak, Onondaga men's basketball head coach for Onondaga Community College, JUCO level here for the NJCAA for the past 13 seasons and counting for Dave Pasiak. Looking at this series and looking at Game 6, who's going to win Game 6 and what's your score?
I think Miami wins Game 6. Probably a little closer than people realize. I'll say Miami wins Game 6 single-digit margin.
So you have Miami winning in single digits. I'm also choosing Miami to win here, and I believe it'll be another closely contested game. I just, in all honesty, no bone in my body thinks that this game is going to end, or that this series, I should say, is going to end in 6. I feel like it's definitely going to get to at least that 7th game. I don't think it's going to end early. I think they're going to use all the time that they have until that final buzzer in Game 7. And for right now, this is the final buzzer on Double Dribble for Wake Up Call DT.com and Dan Tatora Broadcast Media. For Dave Pasiak, and I'm Dan Tatora, thank you so much for listening in. Dave, I can't thank you enough for what you have brought in the first few weeks here of Double Dribble, and I can't wait for what we're going to be able to have from here on out with your expertise. I truly appreciate it.
Well, it's great to be able to talk basketball with you, Dan.